From the Sky News Centre at 6, it's looking increasingly likely David James will be in goal for England in their World Cup match against Algeria this evening. Reports claim Fabio Capello has axed Robert Green for his howler against the USA. Former England goalkeeper Peter Shilton believes Green should keep his place.
I think when you, you're looking at goalkeeping, I think you've got a little bit of consistency. I mean, for example, if David James does play in this next match and he makes a mistake, do we change it again? And it's not the ideal thing.
Earlier today, the USA came from 2-0 down to draw 2-2 with Slovenia, and Germany suffered a shock 1-0 defeat to Serbia. In other news, a soldier from the Royal Dragoon Guards has been killed in an explosion in Afghanistan. It takes the number of British troops who have died since operations there began to 299. His family has been told. More than 120 mourners have attended the funeral of the youngest victim of gunman Derek Bird. 23-year-old Jamie Clark was one of 12 people who died after the taxi driver's shooting spree in West Cumbria. This evening, Derek Bird's funeral has been taking place. The Education Secretary is insisting that allowing parents and teachers to set up their own schools will drive up standards, particularly in deprived areas. From today, interested groups can begin for the application process. Michael Gove says poorer kids will benefit.
Many of the people who are most anxious to see these new schools set up are teachers who explicitly want to go and work or are working in areas of disadvantage because they've been inspired by what's been happening in America and elsewhere, and they want to do the same thing here.
French President Nicolas Sarkozy has been visiting London to mark the 70th anniversary of Charles de Gaulle's defiant World War II broadcast from the city. The speech inspired the French resistance movement. And in showbiz, Jude Law has been named the hottest film father, beating competition from George Clooney, Will Smith and even Darth Vader. He tops the poll for his role in the romantic comedy The Holiday. 1,500 film fans took part in the survey. That's the latest. I'm Rachel Jewell.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Do you think you have a problem with cocaine or other drugs? Cocaine Anonymous can help. Visit our website www.cauk.org.uk. We're here and we're free. Call 0800 612 0225.
Seventh-day Adventist Church presents Impact Bristol, the March Against Crime, kicking off at 2:30 sharp at Eastville Park, marching to Castle Park. There you will find stalls and information. Leads on to a concert at the waterfront from 4:30 to 6:30. Then, the gospel concert at the Baptist Church, City Road, St. Paul's, Bristol, 8 p.m. till 10 p.m.
For more information, contact Colin on 07 9844 33075, or check out the website www.bristolcentral.adventistchurch.org. Remember, this is all free. Impact Bristol, Saturday the 19th of June.
Are you discouraged or disheartened? Are you in distress or in debt? Do you feel that you are unlucky? Does your child need help with schoolwork? If you have answered yes to any one of the questions, come and learn how to become a champion and be victorious over these challenges using dynamic biblical principles at Champions House. Every Sunday, 12 to 2, City Academy, Bristol, Carlton House, Redfield. www.championshouse.com.
Bristol Community FM 93.2.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with me, Tony Gosling. Well, our former parachute regiment reporter, Bryn Richard Cowley, will be looking soon at the Savile report, which came out this week, into the Bloody Sunday killings. Has the £191 million report thrown any light on whether soldiers, senior officers or politicians of the day were responsible? And Mike Birkin is here from the Bristol Friends of the Earth to look at the announcement this week that brings two nuclear power stations on our doorstep closer. And he'll be explaining about the public inquiry coming up into the proposed Avonmouth biofuel power station. But first, Martin Summers is here with me, and we're going to have a detailed look at the Chancellor George Osborne's Mansion House speech this week. Now, Martin, why is it that these Mansion House speeches take place? You know, this happens every year, doesn't it? The Chancellor gives a speech to the great and good of the city.
Well, I mean, it's a yearly fixture, and the Chancellor of the Exchequer is penciled in, whoever that may be. I mean, it used to be Gordon Brown, used to be Alistair Darling. This year it's George Osborne, and of course it's a very, very select audience. It's the Mansion House speeches to the corporation of the City of London, which is a kind of private body almost, representing the interests of the city, and those are the people who'll be sitting in the pews.
Well, the Mansion House is the official residence of the Lord Mayor of the City of London, but it's not quite like other local authorities, is it?
Oh, no, the corporation of the City of London is essentially a private body. It's not like the GLC or the London, the elected London government. It's a private body that sits there representing the interests of the City of London, that is to say the merchant guilds, and it's been a very powerful institution for many hundreds of years.
Okay, so let's have a look now, listen now again to a second clip, because we heard one in the first hour from George Osborne, and I'd just like to get your comments after it's finished, Martin.
And I have sat at this dinner in the past and listened to the then Chancellor express one view, the Governor express another, while everyone knew the Prime Minister held a third view and the regulator held a fourth. And this cannot go on. We need to resolve these issues and end the uncertainty in a way in which everyone feels that they have had a chance to make their case. And that is why the new government is establishing an independent commission on the banking industry. And my colleague Vince Cable and I have worked closely together to put this together. It will look at the structure of banking in the United Kingdom, the state of competition in the industry, and how customers and taxpayers can be sure of the best deal.
Now, an independent commission into the banking industry, this is surely exactly what we need, something which is just completely independent of all of the vested interests.
Yeah, but the question is whether it would be independent of the vested interests. I mean, that's the $64,000 question, isn't it? I mean, obviously, we do need to reform the banking industry. I think that's common ground across the political spectrum. Let's see what they actually come up with.
Well, the previous regime was something called the tripartite regime, yeah, which was between, I think it was the Bank of England, was it, the Financial Services Authority and the Treasury.
Yeah.
And now, really, what Osborne is saying is that the FSA, Financial Services Authority, and the Treasury are out of the window. They don't really need to be involved. Let's just let the Bank of England make some of these most important decisions.
Yeah, and the Bank of England is independent of the government because Gordon Brown made it so. I mean, until very recently, the Bank of England was basically under the political control of the Prime Minister and the Chancellor, and there was one line of command from Prime Minister to Chancellor to Bank of England. Now, of course, we've got an independent Bank of England, which is now being bigged up to be the big beast in the jungle. Now, there's an element of rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic here, because the real problem rests within the private banking system. And that's the private banking system which has created all of the problems. And perhaps that's what we need to look at. Perhaps we ought to get rid of the private banking system. Perhaps we ought to think about having a public banking system.
So do you think the Bank of England should have a monopoly then?
No, I don't. I think the Bank of England, it should not be... the idea of the Bank of England as an independent force is based on the idea that economic questions are essentially technical questions. And as long as we've got the best brains in the Bank of England, they will come up with the technically correct solution. Now, most economic questions aren't actually technical questions. If we're deciding, for example, where the pain is going to fall in an economic depression or recession, that's a political decision. It's not really a technical decision. And the delusion that it is a technical decision is simply a delusion. I don't think that the independence of the Bank of England, which was Gordon Brown's big idea when he first came to power, is actually such a good idea. The Bank of England ought to be under political control, that is to say under democratic control.
Well, why isn't it? Because it is supposed to be, surely, if it's a nationalised bank.
Yes, but the point is it's been set up as a quango now. So it is funded by the taxpayer, if you like. It's not like the Federal Reserve in the US, which is actually run by the banking industry. It is independent of the banking industry, but it's also independent of the government. And that means basically that it's independent of everybody. Now, that's not really very satisfactory to my mind, especially when you've got difficult decisions. Those difficult decisions are fundamentally political decisions. We've got to argue them out politically, and then the Bank of England has got to be instructed accordingly. And of course, in the old days, the fiscal policy, which is to do with taxes and spend, and the monetary policy were coordinated together, by the government, whereas now the monetary policy is decided by the Bank of England, but the fiscal policy is decided by the government. So we've still got two potentially competing centres of power. I think there should be one line of command, and that line of command should be under democratic control.
But isn't the idea that the Bank of England is made up of professional people who really know the way that the economy works actually better than some people from government, and there's been too much government interference in the past?
Well, there's always the potential for government to be short-term in its you know, for example to want to boost the economy just before an election and so on and so forth. And there is a case to be made for some kind of semi-autonomy from the government, but nevertheless you can't have a situation where major decisions are essentially being taken by bureaucrats and not by people who are answerable to the people.
Okay, let's have a final listen now to George Osborne's Mansion House speech here earlier this week, and where he talks about some of the conclusions that he's drawn.
What we are proposing is a new system of regulation that learns the lessons of the greatest banking crisis of our lifetime. I can confirm that the government will abolish the tripartite regime and the Financial Services Authority will cease to exist in its current form. We will create a new prudential regulator which will operate as a subsidiary of the Bank of England. It will carry out the prudential regulation of financial firms, including banks, investment banks, building societies and insurance companies. We will create an independent financial policy committee at the bank, which will have the tools and the responsibility to look across the economy at the macro issues that may threaten economic and financial stability and take effective action in response. We will also establish a powerful new Consumer Protection and Markets Authority. It will regulate the conduct of every authorised financial firm providing services to consumers.
Well, that last announcement was something quite positive. It sounds like a sort of Office of Fair Trading. He's trying to extend the powers of possibly, I think it's actually the city really here, to actually start regulating the way that companies do business and to stop monopolistic practices.
Yeah, I mean, we're now coming to fundamental questions about how the world works. The idea that promotion of competition is the answer to a problem of monopoly is potentially wrong. Sometimes monopoly is almost inevitable. And when you've got monopoly is almost inevitable, perhaps what you need to do is actually have control of that monopoly, rather than the idea that if we bring in competition, this will somehow solve the problem. We've often discussed, for example, local transport buses on this programme. And the idea that more competition will somehow solve the problem is simply wrong. There probably is only one or possibly two companies are going to run the local bus industry, and therefore in actual fact you might be better off accepting that it's a monopoly and then running it as a monopoly under public democratic control. So what I would suggest, maybe the future of the banking industry is not regulation, it's nationalisation and making nationalisation work.
OK, Martin, thank you. We'll be hearing from Mike Birkin from Friends of the Earth in a moment. But first, let's hear way back. I think this is even as far as the late 1980s. This is Gary Clayle.
There's something wrong with human nature.
1991, in fact, not the 1980s, as I said beforehand. That's Gary Clayle and Something Wrong with Human Nature. Gary Clayle on U Sound System. Anyway, I'm pleased to welcome Mike Birkin from Bristol the Friends of the Earth to the studio. Hi, Mike.
Hello, Tony.
And we are going to discuss, I think, today the biofuel plant, which is planned at Avonmouth. Now, can you just explain, first of all, how a biofuel plant is designed to generate electricity? How does it work?
Yeah, it's same as any other power station, but the fuel that they burn in it is derived from various kinds of plant matter. Originally, there was, this started off as a small-scale industry where you'd burn stuff like recycled vegetable oil that had been, you could put it in your tank and use it as instead of diesel, and that was seen to be, you know, a thoroughly good thing, because basically you were saving burning fossil fuel. You were just burning vegetable stuff of recent origin. It didn't change the balance of the atmosphere. It was a little bit of contribution towards cutting our carbon footprint. Problem now is this has been taken up because of the incentives, the financial incentives that have been offered to the industry. It's been taken up on a huge scale by transnational companies, and vast areas of Indonesia and other countries are being turned over to plantations for the growing of palm oil, which is creating huge economic and social problems in the areas where it happens. And but even worse than that, its carbon footprint is probably even worse than that of burning oil.
So where are these financial incentives coming from?
Well, they're coming partly from the system that the government set up to encourage renewable energy, called renewable energy certificates, which allows any generator who's using a renewable source of power to claim a bit of cash back on electricity they put into the system. I mean, that's it's a pretty sensible policy initiative, while industries like wind power are having to break into a market, then to give them a help to recognise that renewable sources of energy are more desirable, then to give them some help to break into the market is, you know, a thoroughly wise government decision. But it's being abused now by an industry that is generating electricity in the name, calling it renewable power, but in actual fact generating impacts every bit as bad as that of the fossil fuel industry.
So I imagine that the reason it's being sited at Avonmouth is so that it's there ready for shiploads of stuff to be brought in from abroad.
Absolutely, yeah. There's a large number of these power stations proposed, some of them burning solid material, you know, timber imports, and some of them burning liquid fuels. The timber imports is a little bit more of a sort of balanced issue as to whether or not that is can be a sustainable industry or not. But with the liquid fuels, I think there's, you know, no way with the present technologies could you source that quantity of liquid fuel sustainably. We already had problems. There was the European Union set a target for increasing the amount of biofuel that's burnt in transport fuels. You're adding biodiesel to diesel, and the market that has created, the pressure it's created on land around the world, has already led to food riots and, you know, shortages and, you know, real impacts on poorer countries. And this move now to add burning fuel oil, biofuels in power stations, is only going to intensify that pressure.
Now, I know the City Council, for what it's worth, turned down the application, didn't they? But that isn't the end of the story, because the whole planning system is a little bit skewed in favour of the developers, where the developers are allowed to appeal against the decision, but local people are not allowed to. So where does things stand at the moment?
Yeah, you got it absolutely right. And where things stand at the moment is that the developers have appealed, and there will be a public inquiry which will be held in Bristol in August, where the City Council and the developers will make their cases. And we are also, Bristol Friends of the Earth are part of a consortium of independent objectors, so we will also be making our case at the inquiry.
Martin, what about the wider economics of this whole subject? Because it does seem that we're being told that, that some of the old-fashioned forms of energy, like gas and coal, being non-renewable, these supplies are going to run out, so we need to find alternatives. Sounds to me like people have found an alternative with biofuel, and now they're being told, oh, you can't use that.
Yeah, I mean, one of the real problems is that is the creation of futures markets in food and in fuel, which leads to a situation where speculators effectively can bid up the price of fuel and of food. The commodity future exchange was deregulated in 2000 in the US, so a lot of food price problems are being caused by speculators bidding up, buying grain, as forward contracts, and creating bubbles. So a lot of what we think of as the market price for something is in fact a distorted price created by the system that we've set up, which allows speculators to speculate in these commodities. We probably need a bit more planning on every level of what we really want to be doing. And just to pick up on the biofuel, in Colombia, for example, there's paramilitaries are often used by allied with the government drive peasants off the land. 3 million people have been displaced in Colombia, and then of course once they're gone, these companies move in and turn the land over to making biofuel. These kind of impacts in the developing world are pretty horrendous. I think what we really need to think about doing is consuming less of everything, rather than thinking about how much more we can get out of this or that source of energy. We've got to change our lifestyle so that we're consuming a lot less energy, and then our impact will be that much more benign.
Mike, what is this biofuel? Is it just sort of ground up bits of plant matter and leaves and things like that?
In the case of the palm oil, it's just like you make any other oil. You put pressure on the vegetable matter and a liquid oozes out of it. But they are actually proposing to use something that is called palm oil derivatives, and you're kind of testing my technical knowledge there a little bit beyond its limits as to what the difference is. I'd just like to come back to your question then about, you know, we're told that we need to change to renewables, then it seems that everything that comes forward is bad. That's by no means the picture at all. This proposed power station at Avonmouth is a 50 megawatt plant. Now that's not very big in power station terms, although in terms of the impact it would have in terms of importing the palm oil, it is potentially big. But there is, at the same time going forward, there is a proposal for a power station of 1,000 megawatts, 20 times the size, out beyond Lundy Island, called the Atlantic Array, and that is going to be basically a huge array of offshore wind turbines. And I think developments like that really are exciting. We've already got a development of similar size underway in the Thames Estuary. There's a proposal for an even bigger one off the coast of North Wales. I mean, there's very little negative environmental impact that these things are going to cause, and there's a fantastic resource because the wind just blows out there out at sea pretty much day in, day out. And for that kind of development to be the basis of our energy use, I think is a fantastic future prospect.
Well, I hate to burst your bubble, but isn't it going to be just a matter of time before some colossal great container ship crashes into one of these wild, you know, these offshore wind farms, which are right out in the middle of nowhere, in, you know, right in the centre of the Bristol Channel?
Well, they managed to steer their way moderately successfully around Lundy Island for the past few centuries, so I think, you know, if they know it's there, I can't see that's going to be a problem.
Okay, so Martin, what about we're being told often about peak oil and the idea that oil is going to run out, and we've reached the peak of consumption, the peak of the ability to consume oil. Is this something you go along with?
I don't know to be is the simple answer to that. What I do know is that the oil price is a largely artificial price created through these speculative mechanisms that I outlined earlier. So it may well be that it's in the interests of oil companies to pretend that peak oil is close because they want the, they want a high price, or not the oil companies but the people buying oil futures. I think we've all, we've got to actually re-regulate the economic system as a whole so that we can be pretty confident that the prices that we're looking at are genuine prices and not being affected by these speculative bubbles, and then we've got to make our decisions. But clearly what we have to do is consume less. It's not just a question of finding new sources so that we can carry on being profligate. The obvious answer to a lot of our problems is energy efficiency, with technology which is absolutely straightforward and we know about and doesn't have any bad effects at all.
Martin, that's very easy to say, but if someone is, say for example, commuting 45 minutes in each direction to and from work every day, how on earth are they supposed to, they can't just up sticks and
what you need to have is an overall plan to reduce energy consumption. The idea that individual choices, I mean, people should take individual choices obviously to improve their energy footprint and their carbon footprint and all the rest of it, but ultimately it requires collective action, and that requires, I mean, in World War II we had collective plans to decide how much oil and coal we needed, get the convoys through and all the rest of it. Some kind of indicative planning of quantities is perfectly rational. The market isn't the answer for every problem. It never was and it never will be.
Is there any sign of a plan, Mike, to meet the country's energy needs then? I think Martin's quite right when he's talking about, you know, this stuff does need to be thought about beforehand. And does such a plan exist?
No, it doesn't really, unfortunately. I mean, the government came out with something, the previous government came out with a low carbon transition strategy for the UK, which had a lot of good things in it. And it was a kind of glimmer for the first time that the senior civils, for the first time in a very long time, that the senior civil servants in Department of Energy and Climate Change and elsewhere were actually beginning to think, we can't just leave it to the market, can we? If we just leave it to the market, we're not necessarily going to get the right kind of investment coming forward that really does give us the green energy we need for the future. Unfortunately, I think the steps that the government has taken, also the previous government has taken since then, has kind of undone that. They came up with a national policy statement on energy that more or less said you can build whatever you like wherever you feel like it, because we need lots of energy, and it didn't actually give any sort of direction to investors or to the energy companies that said we're going to favour renewable energy over other sorts.
So if you had your own choice and you could build whatever type of power plant you wanted down at Avonmouth, what would it be?
Well, I think the Port of Bristol has already put three wind turbines up. The City Council are planning another two. Those are valuable, but they're not as large in terms of capacity as burning power stations would be. So I think probably Avonmouth has got a certain amount to contribute, and it could also, because of its, its communication links and so on, because there is land down there, it could also be a place where you processed wastes which come from the agricultural system around the southwest. If you're talking about bringing in indigenous produced material that otherwise is going to go to waste. But sometimes I think some of these things are not most appropriately dealt with in big facilities. I mean, it may be that the best way to use waste products from the land, be it animal slurries or crop residues and that kind of thing, forestry residues, it may be that the best way to use those is in smaller units closer to the farm, and have a more distributed, more decentralised energy system.
Now, getting back to the public inquiry into the Avonmouth biofuel plant, how can listeners and everyone, contribute to that? Is it something that there's in government actually, and the inspector actually encourages people to contribute from around the city?
Believe it or not, yes, they do. The planning inspectorate is open to receive contributions from members of the public. The best address I can give you to find it is actually Biofuel Watch. So if you check on that, biofuelwatch.org.uk, I think it is, and on their front page, they've got a button you can press that will take you through to the planning inspectorate and will allow you to send them a letter expressing your opinion. And up until the day that the inquiry begins, which is 10th of August, anybody can do that.
Now, I know one of the things Friends of the Earth does spend quite a lot of time on is energy policy, and we're hearing this week that there's a bit of a split, really, between the... Not a bit of a split, a massive split, really, between the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives on the whole issue of whether there are likely to be new nuclear plants in Britain, and particularly here, where we're facing the possibility of two down alongside the Bristol Channel.
Yes, yeah, that's right. Yeah, it is... a potential, it's not only a split between the Conservatives and Liberal Democrats, it appears to be a split between Chris Huhne and Chris Huhne, who's in an awkward position of, you know, having represented the Liberal Democrat policy and being personally committed to a policy of opposing new nuclear power stations, and now being a member of a coalition government where the Conservatives, the major partner in the coalition, is in favour of it. And so his job as Energy Secretary is actually sort of to promote that. But the kind of the line they're treading at the moment, which is, I suppose, the best compromise they can come up with, is to say that they won't oppose new nuclear build, but they will oppose any public subsidy for it. So it's got to find its way in the open market. Now, I think that's one to watch, because the nuclear industry has had 60 years practice at cooking the books, and they're very good at disguising the true level of state support for that industry. They've constantly restructured and hid things away in various places, and the nuclear industry creates absolutely massive liabilities, and these new plants that they're proposing to build, that could be even more so than it has been in the past, because the fuel that those once the fuel has been burnt in this new generation of power stations, it's not the present generation. What they do is they leave it, they put it in a pond, they put it underwater for a few months, then they put it in a flask, they take it up by rail up to Sellafield, where all the high-level nuclear waste from all of Britain's nuclear programme in the past is kept. The new power stations, the fuel will be intensely radioactive and have to be left on site for 160 years before it can be moved. So we're creating massive liabilities for the future. Not only financial, but...
Yeah, so poor old Chris Huhne is in a bit of a cleft stick, isn't he? Being a Lib Dem energy minister. But what I'm just having a little look on the internet here, and it says that that he apparently will speak in the Commons against a planning statement that which would allow the new nuclear power stations, but his party must abstain in the vote. Yes. So this is all proving rather awkward, isn't it? Martin.
Well, yes, I mean, it's an example of how these strange bedfellows are finding it quite difficult to get used to lying in bed with each other, isn't it?
Okay, so well, let's what's your guess then, Mike? Do you think that these two nuclear power stations will get the go ahead? Because we're asking this question on this programme probably at least once a month, and right. it seems right. Every time we get a different answer, so it's in the balance. But what's your guess?
The history here is quite interesting. In a new power station at Hinkley Point, a new nuclear power station at Hinkley Point, did actually get planning permission in the late 80s, and never built. The economics of the nuclear industry were changed, partly due to the privatisation drive of the previous Conservative government, and it was never built. So my guess, if I was a betting man, would be that some of these permissions on paper will be forced through. The nuclear renaissance won't happen. Maybe there will be one of these things built. I don't think the whole programme that they have in mind of 10 massive new nuclear sites around the coast of Britain, I don't think anything on that scale is ever going to materialise.
Okay, Mike, well, thanks, and we'll invite you back next month to take the next
20 years, I think. Invite me back and see if I was right.
Okay, anyway, we'll speak to you again next month once you come back from your holiday. Thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Tony.
Now, the release of the Savile Report into the shooting dead of 14 unarmed civilians on Bloody Sunday in January 1972 is significant because the British Army's actions on that day massively accelerated IRA recruitment and led indirectly to the deaths of thousands of people on both sides of the nationalist-unionist divide. Britain Richard Cowley is a former soldier in the Parachute Regiment, which were responsible for the 14 civilian deaths on Bloody Sunday. So here's his report into Bloody Sunday and the Savile Report's conclusions.
The British government basically sent troops initially into North Ireland in 1969 after a speech by the Prime Minister then of the Irish Republic, Jack Lynch, who was regarded by many as outrageous interference or interferer, in which he therefore called for a United Nations peacekeeping force to be set up instead in the province. And for Anglo-Irish talks on the future of Northern Ireland. But instead, the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, Major, at the time, and Major James Chichester Clark, responded by saying that neighbourly relationships between the Republic of Ireland were at an end, and that instead British troops were being called in. So this just goes to show you the attitude, the wrong attitude, that the British government and Northern Ireland were taking against the NICRA, Northern Ireland, Ireland Civil Rights Association, or the Movement for Civil Rights at the time. They were the main body of peacekeepers and people that initiated, probably through Sinn Féin, most of the demonstrations and petitions and, demos, you know. They were looking for a political doorway of opportunity, a platform to launch a more peaceful initiative so that it would quickly resolve their differences, you know, the unemployment, vast amount of segregation, apartheid, basic sectarianism, etc., by the British against them. And so that was, in my opinion, the British government's first and biggest mistake. Major James Chichester, the British Home Secretary at the time, James Callaghan, was apparently in a plane on his way to talks with then the Prime Minister Harold Wilson in Cornwall, where he then received a telephone call, a radio call, asking for troops to be deployed. Between 1969 and 1972, which January 72, there was excessive use of violence by the IUC. The IRA were responding significantly in the same way. Bombs were being going off. Time bombs were being thrown. The whole place was in chaos, basically. Every well-trodden, locally known corner where IRA people and Sinn Féin, NICRA, etc., had demonstrated with petitions. Petitions that were thrown out basically by the IUC consistently, they were banging their head against the wall by that stage, and they were getting angry about this. And so the government had responded incorrectly by sending troops in to try and quell the problem by force, which was their big mistake. And so by the time 1972 arrived, everybody was on tender hooks, and both sides were ready for action, you might say. Everyone was now aware of the recent deaths on both sides, and so they were expecting trouble.
Martin, what do you think? Richard's got it right there, painting a picture of what Derry, Londonderry, was like on Bloody Sunday 1972, just in the run up to when these horrific shootings happened.
I think he's got the sense of crisis correct. I think that what he's missed out on is that, in actual fact, the British Army were welcomed by the Nationalists initially because they were seen as a buffer between them and the, you know, a state which had become out of control. I mean, the IUC were leading mobs of loyalists into Nationalist areas and carrying out killings. And, you know, the faith of the Nationalist community in the state had simply evaporated. So to that extent, the British Army came onto the streets and were initially welcomed. Because there was a presumption that once the British arrived, they would then reform the situation and get a grip on it. And what happened, of course, was that they didn't reform the situation. They carried on allowing the Unionists. I mean, James Chichester Clark, who was the Prime Minister of Northern Ireland, was allowed to carry on being in charge. After Bloody Sunday, Stormont was prorogued. That is to say that the local parliament, which was dominated by Protestant extremists, if you like, was closed down from London. And why did it take 2 years to do that? I mean, what the Nationalists were looking for was that to be closed down straight away. The British Army gets a grip on the situation, and the IRA would never have been happy with that because they always had an agenda of violence, it has to be said. But they would have been marginalised by that. But of course, in actual fact, the way it played out, they were not marginalised at all. The British state played right into their hands, and with all of the consequences that we now know.
Okay, so now we're going to hear Richard talking about General Robert Ford and apparently a top secret memo which came out as part of the Savile Inquiry.
The Savile Inquiry has dug up a number of points that have been contested, nevertheless, by existing QCs and other people. Lord Gifford QC put it to Lord Carrington when he was cross-examined in the Bloody Sunday Inquiry that the government had been willing to risk the lives of innocent Catholics in order to appease Protestant opinion in Northern Ireland. Lord Gifford's line of questioning, Lord Savile said, was alleging that the design of the British government was to shoot people on the streets of Derry that afternoon in the hope and expectation that it would aid the political process. Carrington replied laconically to that, it did not seem very likely. Now, it has to be understood that Lord Carrington has a previous military background himself. In fact, he was awarded the MC, the Military Cross, which is a very significant medal of honour and bravery, in the Second World War, in 1945. Edward Heath, who was then the Prime Minister after Harold Wilson, was also a Lieutenant Colonel and a significant regiment that he belonged to, which is now called the RHA, the Right Honourable Household Artillery, where he was actually active up until 1971, inspecting troops. So both people had significant military involvement at high-ranking levels. So Lord Carrington, who was then the Defence Secretary at the time of Bloody Sunday shootings in 72, said that there was never any question of the military opening fire on innocent civilians. General Robert Ford, at the time, expressed in a top-secret memo written just 3 weeks prior to Bloody Sunday, said that the best way to restore law and order was to shoot a few Londonderry hooligans. General Robert Ford was second in command in Northern Ireland to ground forces. But the interesting point is that Carrington, Lord Carrington, also denied that the appointment of General Robert Ford had signalled anyway a change of heart by his government. Lord Carrington dismissed suggestions, therefore, that there was a plan to deal with Londonderry by taking the sort of action which, in fact, we saw on Bloody Sunday. Yeah, he said that the suggestion of using premeditated military force simply didn't comply with the army's rules of engagement contained in the yellow card, which was issued to troops on the ground.
Now, this is pretty shocking stuff that's come out as part of the Savile report, Martin. How on earth do you think General Robert Ford expected that by shooting some Londonderry hooligans that could help restore law and order?
Well, I think what Savile has said is that played no part in what happened, and I think that's disputable. Ivan Cooper, who is a leader of the Northern Ireland Civil Rights Association and a Protestant, he's come out in the last couple of days saying, well, actually what's happened here is that senior officers have been basically excused, and all of the blame is being put on the frontline soldiers who overreacted, supposedly. And now this is jolly convenient for all concerned, apart from those frontline soldiers. I think the parachute regiment were an inappropriate tool to be using. I mean, lots of people were saying that this is the kind of thing that, you know, they're trained to go storming into places and blast them to pieces. They're not really designed for doing peacekeeping operations. So there was an element of foolishness at the very least in using the paras on that day, and there were alternatives. But I think what seems to have happened is that the premeditated plan to shoot a few so-called, local hooligans has been brushed under the carpet here again. The army as an institution has been blamed, but it's been blamed in a sort of, oh, well, they overreacted sort of a way. I think that there's actually evidence to suggest that there was planning behind what happened on Bloody Sunday, and it wasn't just an overreaction.
But what was General Robert Ford's logic? I mean, how can he think that shooting Londonderry hooligans is going to help restore law and order?
Well, don't forget that the parachute regiment had just been deployed in Aden, which is now South Yemen, and they shot quite a lot of people when they were there, and lots of people were... I mean, you've got to remember that the British Army has got quite a long record of doing this kind of thing in Kenya, in Aden, elsewhere, and they were just going to do it in Ireland. But of course, in Ireland, you've got people on the other side who've also got their traditions of fighting back, and you're actually, basically giving them pretty much what they want from an IRA operational point of view. Bloody Sunday was a tragedy, but it was also a fantastic recruiting tool for them, as was the imposition of internment. I mean, the Ballymurphy killings, when internment was introduced, lots of people were shot dead and beaten to death by British soldiers as they were being interned, and that's another people in the six counties know about this, but most of Middle England is oblivious to this. They've heard of Bloody Sunday, but they haven't heard of Ballymurphy, just as they haven't heard of the bombings, the Dublin and Monaghan bombs, which the Garda Síochána have suggested were carried out by British intelligence.
But do you think it's possible that General Robert Ford was thinking, well, look, if we actually create an incident here, this is going to force the politicians to come round the table?
I think they were basically doing what the British Army has often done, which is the idea that brute force will get you what you want. And of course, after 30 years of hide and seek with the IRA, they've realised that that's not the way to do things. There was always a possibility of trying to negotiate a way out of this, but it would have required standing up to the Unionists. And of course, the Conservative government of the day had no intention of standing up to the Unionists. They were in alliance with them. It's good to see that David Cameron, as a Conservative Prime Minister, has accepted the Savile Report. But I think what Ivan Cooper, who was one of the leaders of the civil rights movement on the day and a Protestant, said is that the senior officers have got off very lightly here, and I think they have.
Now, let's have another listen to Richard, and here he's talking about the role of Prime Minister of the day, Edward Heath.
The former Prime Minister, Edward Heath, testified in the inquiry that there was no standing government issue of a shoot-to-kill policy then. A QC clerk also drew attention to Edward Heath's request at the time, prior to 1972, Bloody Sunday, for a specific report on what would be the implications of seeking a purely military solution in Northern Ireland, which is a very strange question to ask, and considering that Edward Heath was an ex-military lieutenant colonel himself, perhaps it's not. Heath then contradicts himself when he is asked in the inquiry and says that decisions were made by military officers alone on the scene as to what action to take, and yet he's previously asked for a military report. Heath insisted that in the Savile inquiry that he also had no knowledge at all of any premeditated plans to violently suppress civil rights demonstrations planned for January the 30th, 1972. Now, why would that question be raised, if it wasn't relevant? Heath also went on to say that he had no knowledge of discussions among the top army brass to, one, shoot unarmed demonstrators, two, no inkling of any plans to use the notorious 1st Battalion of the Parachute Regiment for an arrest operation, or three, no clue as to the army's intention to send troops into the Bogside area, which was a no-go zone. Prime Minister Edward Heath's policy at the time was to prop up the Protestant Ulster Unionist government, which was then led at the time by Prime Minister Brian Faulkner. During the autumn of 1971, Brian Faulkner had requested from England more troops and a military offensive against the IRA, but particularly in Derry and in specific in the Bogside and the Craigan estate areas. General Robert Ford, again, the commander of land forces in Northern Ireland at the time, then drew up proposals for members of the Derry Young Hooligans, a Catholic youth, to be shot. And that's an actual extract from the Savile inquiry. Heath nevertheless denies that he ever saw that document, despite it being issued to Ford's superior at the time, General Harry Tuzo.
I think many people won't necessarily think of Ted Heath, Edward Heath, the Prime Minister of the day, as a sort of orchestral conductor and someone who's interested in sailing, not an ex-military officer, Martin.
Well, he was a military officer in World War II, as Richard's rightly pointed out.
He was doing inspections, apparently, right up till 1971 of military units.
Yeah. I think that what Savile has done is effectively blamed the powers on the spot for what happened. And of course, I think that any sane person would realise that what they were doing was out of order. Other powers have testified against other powers, saying that they were shooting people who had white flags, they were shooting people. I mean, it wasn't just a fusillade of shots Bloody Sunday. It went on for 25 minutes. People were running in terror, and throughout that whole period, people were were being shot dead, and people were coming out trying to help wounded, and they were being shot in the head, and so on. Now, any responsible soldier should realise that that's not on. But to a certain extent, those frontline troops were responsible for what they were doing and their own actions. I mean, certain paras shot and others did not. Yeah, so some paras did not misbehave on that day and others did. But I think we've got to look really more at the background of the military leadership and the political leadership. There was a definite idea that by showing the smack of firm government, I mean, the Bogside was under the control of the nationalist community, of the IRA, it was a no-go area. Now, of course, eventually that in Operation Motorman, that was got rid of. But I mean, at least some element of the truth has come out. I do sympathise with those on the Protestant side and on the British side saying, well, there's an awful lot of other things that were not looked into. That's true. And in actual fact, there's an awful lot of things the British Army have done which were worse than Bloody Sunday, which haven't been looked into, like the activities of the Force Research Unit and the Brigadier, or then Colonel Gordon Kerr, who was actually commissioning terrorist acts, far more dangerous and far more sinister than shooting to kill in a demonstration. But I think we are ultimately going to have to keep digging away at the historical record and trying to find the truth, not for the sake of punishing people, but for the sake of reconciliation and peace, because that's what we really want to see, isn't it?
Anyway, I think we're really privileged to have Bryn Richard Cowley, who is himself actually an ex-soldier in the parachute
regiment, who served in Northern Ireland.
Who also served in Northern Ireland, to do this report for us. And in this section of the report, he looks at whether or not the soldiers themselves were guilty of murder.
So, are the support company soldiers, this one para, guilty of murder?
In short, well, yes. The Savile report says particularly concisely that they are. It goes on to say that the Savile inquiry has strongly condemned the behaviour of the soldiers who opened fire that day, and it says that there were a serious and widespread loss of fire discipline. Soldiers were motivated by fear and panic. And there were also, it says, soldiers who were specifically not motivated by fear or panic, but both are guilty of shooting at unarmed civilians.
What about prosecutions, potentially?
Well, I mean, I don't know anything about that. All that I've read in the Savile inquiry is that Cameron has not necessarily volunteered any specific comment on that point. He's left it open.
What about prosecutions, Martin?
Well, I'll echo the words of Martin McGuinness earlier this week. He said, well, we're going to be guided in this by the views of the families. We don't want to just drag all this up for the sake of it. There's got to be... What we ought to have done in the inquiry, in my view, is to say to people, if you tell us the truth, we will guarantee that you won't be prosecuted because we want to find out what happened. We're more interested in that than in pointing the finger of blame.
OK, now, in his penultimate report, Bryn Richard Cowley looks at whether or not the shootings were actually justified and explains the soldiers' yellow card system.
Was there any justification for the soldiers opening fire? And typically of the Widgery report, the same thing can be said and was said by the troops on the ground, and that is that they suspected they were being attacked by nail bombs, that Martin McGuinness had, in fact, said in the Savile inquiry that he had placed some what he called super snipers that were overlooking William Street, and that one of those snipers is suspected to have fired first at approximately 5 to 4 that afternoon at a machine gun position in William Street, which they then obviously assumed, you know, was reason to return fire. At the same time in William Street, a nail bomber was said to have attempted to throw something in their direction. So that gave them cause to open up. And in that particular instance, two people were shot dead, two civilians. Later, at 4:05, in another area of the Bogside, well, in fact, in Rossville Flats area, this is when Lieutenant Colonel Wilford decided to initiate an action which led to support company being deployed into the Rossville area, which, however, was not in his orders. He decided that himself. And after so doing, an officer on the ground had fired two shots above the heads of known protesters because he thought that he was in danger, his rifle may have been taken, he was being overwhelmed by thousands of people. We have to realise there was up to 7,000 people on the streets that day, and so there was fear and panic at all ranks and levels. People said they'd heard shots. There was plastic bullets previously being fired that day. There was a smell in the air, helicopters were overhead. The whole thing was very, very panicky and sensitive. And so people were apt to open up very easily. People were saying that they saw gunmen in windows and they'd fired at it legitimately. Yellow card rules were applied that day, but in the crowd and the melee and the noise, obviously no witnesses, particularly on the RA side, would want to testify to that. And also, Martin McGuinness had testified in the Savile inquiry. People suspected that Martin McGuinness had been carrying a submachine gun, a Thompson machine gun, on him that day. Martin McGuinness that day was a young man, and he was said to be in charge of the IRA at the time. Given that from 1969 to 1972, there were so many deaths, and the IRA were certainly active, the paras on the ground were certainly expecting trouble and to be sniped at. People were defending themselves, their weapons, with their lives, so the whole thing was a right mess, basically. You couldn't say what was going on. But for them to shoot 14 civilians, and sometimes on the ground crawling away or running away...
Now, you mentioned something called yellow card rules.
The yellow card rule was actually quoted in the Savile inquiry, as I mentioned earlier, by Lord Carrington, who was relying upon that specific as part of his defence. The yellow card rule was an invention, basically, that allows a soldier to detach his mind from the panic at the time while he's holding a live weapon, go into his top left-hand pocket, pull out a physical card, a yellow card, which on the back has a set of legal obligations that he has to read to himself, and also shout out loudly to anybody that he thinks is endangering his life, i.e. with a loaded weapon or is about to pull a gun, etc. When he thinks his life's in danger, he has to apply the yellow card rule. So it's a psychological sort of initiative that allows a soldier to think twice, take his finger, you might say, off the trigger before he initiates an action. And all soldiers basically follow that rule. But of course, in the heat of this moment, where you've got helicopters and noise and bangs going off, it's difficult to find testimony or evidence to that.
And in a final report that he's done for us, Bryn Richard Cowley, ex-parachute regiment soldier, tells us what his conclusions are.
12 years and 191 million quid later, David Cameron issued an apology on behalf of the government, where he said that he was deeply sorry about what had happened. The conclusions of the report, he said, were shocking. The inquiry exonerated all Catholic victims. It said that they were not posing a threat or causing death or serious injury. Cameron went on to explain what happened on Bloody Sunday was wrong, and because the government of the day is no longer around, that it fell to him to issue an apology instead. Now, well, I've also served in All Ireland myself with three para. I think it would be fair to say that David Cameron has reached the correct conclusion. It's clearly the case that there are a lot of suspicious issues that go right to the top of the government and right to the top of the MOD, and it's clearly not just the parachute regiment soldiers' fault, who are nevertheless carrying the can of worms of blame, you know.
I obviously agree with that. I think that blaming individual soldiers, it misses the point. It's a whole policy that was being pursued from the top, which needs to be recognised and investigated, but not in terms of punishing people. I mentioned Brigadier Gordon Kerr earlier, who's actually in Iraq, as far as we know. I don't want to see him punished. I want to see everything that was done in the struggle in Northern Ireland looked into in an impartial light, in view of trying to create reconciliation and peace on all sides. Lots of bad things were done by all sorts of people. Let's put it behind us and move on, but let's not forget any of it.
And thank you very much to Bryn Richard Cowley, ex-soldier in the Parachute Regiment, for that report. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Music coming up next, and the most pleasant mash-up to the weekend with Sam, a.k.a. DJ Spungold. Do please join us at 5 on Friday Drive Time each week here on BCFM 93.2. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or would like to suggest a guest for a future show, please go to our webpage, thisweek.org.uk, or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to this week's guest in the first hour, Lib Dem Councillor for Clifton East and Deputy Leader of Bristol City Council, Simon Cook. Thanks also to Marina Morris and Mike Birkin for their reports, and to our old Labour Oxford economist, Martin Summers. Next week, the badger cull. Thousands of protected badgers are destined to die. But is this about medical necessity or our vested interests behind the cull? That's at 6 o'clock next week. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all previous Friday drive times, including my hour-long report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, and our investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose, as well as our special on the Good Friday Agreement and Irish history by going to thisweek.org.uk and clicking on the archives. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend.
CFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.